when daylight returns to the area. The last radar contact showed the chopper flying slowly and extremely low, giving authorities hope that the crew decided to land because of the poor conditions. The helicopter is equipped with enough emergency supplies to last a few days, despite temperatures as low as 30 degrees below zero. For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
Planes have been dropping boxes of dried noodles to survivors of the tsunami in Indonesia. Relief efforts have been hampered there by a shortage of boats. The tsunami devastated a number of coastal villages, killing more than 400 people. Hundreds of others are still missing. 700 miles away, the eruption of a volcano in Indonesia has displaced hundreds of people. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nissan, with the 100% electric, no-gas Nissan Leaf. Innovation for the planet, innovation for all. Details at NissanUSA.com.
Now that our on-air drive is over, WILL would like to say a big thank you to the more than 1,000 listeners who contributed over $171,000 in membership support. Your generous contributions truly make a difference.
This year's elections may be among the most tumultuous in some time. The U.S. House and Senate, as well as the Illinois legislature and the governor's office, are up for grabs, with more competitive races and an unpredictable electorate. From Congress to Springfield to Champaign and surrounding counties, NPR and Illinois Public Media will bring you results and analysis all night, election night, beginning at 7. In-depth election coverage on WILL AM and FM.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, while the central United States is really not thought of as a place where earthquakes are common, it is true that our region has produced some of the most major seismic events in American history. And scientists have estimated that there is a roughly 90% chance of a magnitude 6 or 7 earthquake occurring in this part of the country within the next half century. So that leads to some very important questions. If a quake like that happened today, what sort of damage could we expect? What would be the impact on the people living in the states around the fault zone? And the big question, maybe the biggest question, is, are we ready for such an event? How do we try to prepare? We'll be talking in this part of Focus about the potential impacts of a major quake in our part of the country. And our guest is Amir Al-Nashai. He is head of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at the University of Illinois. He's been here since 2001. Before that, he was professor of earthquake engineering and head of section at Imperial College at University of London in the UK. He's also been visiting professor at a number of other universities, at University of Surrey, Tokyo, Southern California, and also was at the European School for Advanced Studies in Reduction of Seismic Risk in Italy. He's also founder and co-editor of the Journal of Earthquake Engineering. And we'll be talking a good bit, I'm sure, this morning about a report that was done by the folks here at the Center for the Mid-America Earthquake Center, which is housed within the College of Engineering here at University of Illinois, in collaboration with other scientists in other places, a report that was done at the request of the federal government to try to assess the impact of a major quake here. And it is available to read if you go to the Earthquake Center website. You can read it. It is very detailed. We'll try to sketch out the basics. And, of course, this is an opportunity for people to ask questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you are also welcome to send us an email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I suppose that the place to begin is just to talk maybe a little bit about the history of earthquakes in the Midwest, because you know, all the people listening to us, there have been minor quakes here and there, but I don't know that there's anybody around who's going to remember the one that happened in the early 1800s, and that's the thing that we're really concerned about. You know, what sort of history of seismic activity do we have here in this part of the country?
Of course, this is one of the, if you like, the problems or features that causes problems in the region, that earthquakes are not frequent. There are areas that don't have any earthquakes at all, totally aseismic, and these are fine. The areas that have frequent earthquakes, and these are in a sense also fine because people are accustomed to thinking of earthquakes, behaving in a way that's compatible with earthquakes and preparing for them. The tricky part is in between, like our region, where in 1811, 1812, as most of the listeners hopefully know, there were actually 9 earthquakes of magnitude above 6. Out of these 9, there were actually 3 that were above 7. And they happened within, if you like, the winter months of 1811, 1812. If these were to happen again, then something along the lines of what we describe in our report might occur in terms of impact, both short-term and long-term. One of the additional issues that fewer people are aware of is that historical studies of looking at the various layers of sand and other deposits in the region indicate that perhaps 300 to 400 years earlier than 1811, 1812, there were actually series of earthquakes that were intense enough to cause something that we refer to as liquefaction. And liquefaction means that the soil changes from a coherent granular material with some moisture to actually a liquid. And then it ejects through cracks in the ground that looks like a fountain. And then you have these sort of deposits that end up being on the surface that indicate that there has been a liquefaction site in this region, and this can only happen in major earthquakes. So this what we refer to as paleoliquefaction, paleo being the Greek word for old, in Greek it would be paleo, means old liquefaction, shows that major earthquakes happened some hundreds of years before the 1811, 1812. So it's not one incident in history. In fact, there are 3 incidents in history, 2 from archaeological evidence and 1 that we have detailed reports on. So this is of the, if you like, the peculiar seismic history of the region that doesn't lend itself to making a massive case to be prepared.
Well, for, I'm sure that what frustrates people, and I'm sure the same thing frustrates scientists who study earthquakes, is the inability to make precise predictions about where and when. I'm sure that over time we learn more and more about are there warning signs? To what degree can you study the structure under the surface? And, you know, maybe over time we'll get to the point where we'll be able to make better predictions. But right now it seems that all we can really do is go based on past history, what has happened over a particular span of time, and then start to work with probabilities and say, well, this has happened before. We expect it's going to happen again. You know, so then that's when we get into this business of trying to say, well, you know, what can you say about the chances within the next few decades of a major quake happening?
Yes, this is an eternal question, the balance between prediction and protection, if you like. Prediction is really tricky, even in areas that have more frequent earthquakes. Why? Because to have a useful prediction, you need to predict 3 things, not 1, and not 2. These are the size, the location, and the time. You get one of the 3 wrong, the prediction becomes a negative feature, not a positive feature. Imagine, for example, in a region, we say that on Thursday at 4 o'clock, there will be a massive earthquake, and we predict that it would be in Rantoul, for argument's sake. And it will be magnitude 7.5. So we predicted the magnitude correctly and the time correctly. But then it doesn't happen in Rantoul, it happens in Springfield. Through the prediction, people have, in the meantime, moved from Rantoul to Springfield so that they are away from the predicted place. And then you actually intensify the damage. And you can work through scenarios of getting the time wrong, people leave and then they come back, and as soon as they come back, an earthquake happens. Or you say it is a 7.5, it turns to be 4.2, and you alarm people and then they don't believe you next time around. So you have to really get the 3 right. Even in areas of frequent seismicity and very well-studied geological structure, predicting the 3 is really, at this point, it's impossible. And hence we tend to go to protection in the sense that there are common sense things that we can all do with very little cost. There are issues of proper design and detailing of structures and being prepared with stockpiling and making sure that our bridges and roads are in a reasonable shape and they are not deteriorating in the normal way, just waiting for an excuse to fail, if you like. And so taking general precautions of being prepared is probably a much better way forward for a society than to try to predict.
Yeah. Well, what you've done with the report, and we'll talk some more about it, is I think what it seems that you have done is that you have looked at this fault, which has three segments that runs roughly along. You can sort of think of it running kind of along where the Mississippi River goes, the heart of the area, if you have maps here where you show, well, where's the greatest movement going to be? It affects an area that has parts of a number of states where they all kind of come together. So we should see effects in Missouri, Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, down into Mississippi, spreading out from the place where there's the most intense movement. But now, unlike 1811, 1812, we got a lot of people living here now. We have the city of St. Louis. You have the city of Memphis. So the potential for people's lives being affected is really serious because we have a lot of people living around here now. And it seems that what you've done is perhaps looked at the worst case scenario. You know, what would happen if we had a big quake all along this fault? You read this report. This would be enough to keep you up at night because you're talking about very, very significant damage, hundreds of thousands of buildings, bridges, gas pipelines, millions of people without power, people who are hurt, people who are needing help. This could potentially be very, very serious.
Sure. Well, I believe that the assumptions made are balanced in terms of under-prediction and over-prediction. Mm. So it's not a worst-case scenario. I'll start from the magnitude, for example. If you go to the literature on the 1811, 1812, there is a lot of evidence that it was above 8, and yet we used the 7.7. So the 7.7 was used because we worked with the U.S. Geological Survey on what is the most credible as opposed to the maximum. The capability of the fault system is above 8, and we went to 7.7. So this is sort of on the reducing the impact side of things. Let me say a word about the difference between 7.7 and 8.2, for example. This is not a small difference. This is like multiplying the energy by 20 or 25. This is like instead of hitting a region with one nuclear explosion to hit it with 25 nuclear explosions. So between 7.7 and 8.2, there is a long, long, long way to go. So this sort of, if you like, reduces the potential impact. There are issues in the modeling that we had to do that potentially increases the impact, like, for instance, running the whole fault with the three segments at the same time. Mm. We did that for very practical reasons that there are no models in the world that are able to accumulate damage to infrastructure from 1, 2, and 3 earthquakes. The science doesn't exist. We are working on aspects of that so that we can more accurately predict what happens to the infrastructure. But at this moment in time, there are no models to accumulate damage from 3 consecutive earthquakes on the infrastructure, buildings and bridges and pipelines and so on. So this is an assumption that tends to increase the impact. There are other aspects that some of them would increase the impact, some of them would reduce the impact. And our assessment and that of the people whom we worked with in FEMA and our partners in the study from various institutes that cooperated with the University of Illinois, our assessment that this is pretty realistic.
Hmm. The numbers here are truly staggering. Just to look at the executive summary, nearly 715,000 buildings you project would be damaged, 140 impacted counties, 3,500 damaged bridges, 425,000 breaks and leaks in pipelines, approximately 2.6 million households without power after the quake, nearly 86,000 injuries and fatalities, nearly 130 hospitals are damaged, It's sort of hard to imagine.
Yes, for example, yes, you are right. I mean, for a region that has not experienced an earthquake in recent times, these are tough numbers to swallow. Then this is our duty to do our best in terms of really the state of the art in impact assessment and modeling. These are pretty sophisticated models that have been used, and there are no models better than what we have used. We use the best that FEMA has with the best that the May Center has been developing for the last 12 years. And anything that we saw in the literature that is promising, we implemented. In terms of models, for instance, for fire, models for bridge damage, we improved tremendously what we refer to as fragility curves. Fragility curves are the relationship between how intense the shaking is and what is the level of damage to various infrastructure components. These have not been done before. We have the best inventory that anybody can have. We have worked really closely with HSIP, this Homeland Security Information Program, that have accumulated 220 data sets in the U.S. in terms of quite accurate location and characteristics of the infrastructure components. So although they are very tough to swallow, this is a quite a realistic estimate. Mm-hmm.
I have a caller here in a band I want to get to in just a moment. Maybe just let me ask you one further question. The report here, the one that you did for FEMA, I think sort of officially was released in the fall of last year. And I know I saw maybe a couple of articles about this in the news media earlier this year, maybe in the winter and the spring. I guess I'm a little surprised that this hasn't gotten more attention. Are you surprised that it seems that it's not on the front page of every Midwestern newspaper?
It is surprising. There are redeeming aspects and aspects that worry me. The concern is that it has not attracted enough attention from the general media. The redeeming factor is that it has been downloaded some 12,000-13,000 times from our website. But the best, if you like, or the most reassuring feature of all this stuff is that there is now something called the National Level Exercise, NLE, 2011, which is a national effort to prepare the United States for series of earthquakes on the New Madrid Fault. This is run by FEMA headquarters in D.C., and they are entirely using the May Center assessment as the basis for working through the logistics of how will the country respond. So from the government point of view, if you like, there is quite a bit of action taken as a result of this report. From the society point of view, it is surprising. I think maybe to some extent people look at the short-term issues more than the medium and long-term issues, and with the economic environment they focus on sort of what will you do tomorrow as opposed to the probability of a 90% probability of a major earthquake happening in the coming 50 years, say. Can put that aside for now. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Amr Al-Nashah. He's head of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about earthquake in the Midwest and if there was a big quake on the New Madrid Fault, what that would mean for the people who live in Illinois and Indiana and Missouri, Kentucky, Arkansas, Tennessee, all those states that surround it. If you would like to read this report that we're talking about, it is available. If you go to the website of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the University of Illinois, just put that in your browser and you'll get their site. And you can look at this report that the folks here and elsewhere were involved in putting together, looking at the impact of a big earthquake on the New Madrid, in the New Madrid seismic zone that's there. It's quite detailed. Either you can just look at the overview if you like, but there's a great deal of information there going into great depth about what it would mean for infrastructure and people living in this part of the country. We have a caller here, so they've been patient, and we'll get right to them. Someone who is in Urbana and on our line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor, are we doing things or planning to do things that might actually promote earthquakes or exacerbate earthquakes? For example, the carbon sequestration that would accompany something like the Future Gen program?
This is a good question. And the simple answer is that we don't know what actually causes particularly New Madrid fault earthquakes. The New Madrid fault earthquake system is quite deep and quite complex. And as we all know, this is not even a plate boundary. We are not between tectonic plates. There is a theory that this was going to be, in geological times, this was going to be a rift zone, and then it failed to split the continent. And hence they refer to it as a failed rift. Even in fault mechanisms that we understand and have studied and monitored for many years, we do not know if there are triggering mechanisms or not. I give you an example of, for example, in India there was the Koyna Dam constructed, and after it was constructed, a few years later they started picking seismic activity that we can assume that they haven't picked before. Now, immediately some scientists say that this is reservoir impoundment, meaning the pressure of the enormous body of water is pushing onto the plate and causing it to move faster than it used to move previously, and hence it is increasing earthquakes. Now, there is actually a counter theory saying that before the construction of the dam, there were no instruments to measure seismic activity in this region. And since the construction of the dam, you are picking the background seismicity and the movement of the plate that would have been picked regardless of the existence of the dam. It is extremely difficult, really, to establish a cause-effect relationship in this way, because to do that, you would have had to replay history, if you like, once without this stimulus and once with the stimulus. But since we cannot do that, it is always quite controversial to relate things that trigger earthquakes. There is no evidence that carbon sequestration increases fault displacement. It could, but we don't have any evidence to support this.
But we also don't have any evidence that says that putting the plates under such enormous pressure might not actually promote a catastrophic event.
Sure, we don't have, as you said, we don't have evidence to neither confirm nor deny. Perhaps it would be safer to inject CO2 in other regions that are not close to the fault. I think faults should be left to their own devices and leave them to the geological formation to work its magic. And it would be wise, since we don't have evidence to support or deny, to keep away from the fault.
Thank you very much. I hope you relay that to those who are empowered to consider that.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Also, you can send along your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, what you did in this report, essentially, you're looking at three sort of major areas. First, trying to assess what the degree of the hazard, what would be likely to happen if there was the quake. Then what you said was, well, okay, now we see what areas are likely to be affected. And then what you did is you just went out and looked at what was at the vulnerable kind of infrastructure that was there and looked at where are the schools and where are the bridges and where are the airports and where are the hospitals and so forth. And then tried to make some assessment about, well, how vulnerable, how robust or vulnerable are all of these various kinds of systems. So then having come up with an assessment like that, is it possible then, if you try to make some assessment of what all of that is most important, you know, what you would least like to see damaged, is it possible then to do some kind of retrofitting? Can you go back to a building or can you back to a pipeline or a bridge and do something that would make it more resistant?
Yes, and a very big yes, and yes with capital letters. This is the mitigation. In my opinion, mitigation is the way forward. We cannot play with the hazard. The hazard is a geological thing and we cannot affect it. What we have in our hands is the vulnerability. And the risk or the what happens, if you like, is a function of vulnerability multiplied by the hazard. It's an interesting equation that we in the past demonstrated, for example, that there are areas in Europe that are not thought of as very highly seismic that have the same risk like Tokyo. Tokyo is prepared, relatively speaking, but then the hazard is very high. So you have high hazard and low vulnerability, you multiply them together, you get a number. In other areas where the hazard is lower, significantly lower, but the vulnerability is much higher, you multiply them, you get the same number. So you have to always look at the two sides of the equation, hazard and vulnerability, if you like. Now, there is a wealth of ways of retrofitting structures that would improve their performance in earthquakes. And this is really where our effort should be. We say that a dollar spent in mitigation is worth $6 spent in recovery. And we know the technology very, very well. It has been tried in seismic areas in California. There are many, many, maybe hundreds of ways of strengthening everything, from bridges to buildings to pipelines to even stabilizing slopes that support roads and so on. So really, I believe in mitigation in a big way.
Mm. Now, you, in for the purposes of this report, you've come up with an estimate, and it's fairly staggering, hundreds of billions of dollars, that would be the potential costs of the scenario that you lay out. So we know that such a quake would the recovery would be very, very costly. Have you put some sort of estimate on what the cost might be to do the kind of mitigation that you're talking about to try to, again, make structures as robust as possible so that if such a thing would happen, that the damage would be minimized?
Right now we haven't, but redoing the study is really very, very straightforward. And it is extremely simple, relatively speaking, to estimate what would happen if we have strengthened the structures. Because when you were describing quite accurately and amazingly, how did you pick all that from the report? But when you were describing the vulnerability issue, we have actually categorization of each facility, building, bridges, and so on, mm-hmm. whether it is no seismic design, low seismic design, medium, or high. And we know from the history of design codes in this part of the world where the buildings and the bridges and so on lie. If we were to take these numbers and just shift them to a higher level of seismic design, immediately the impact will drop. A very rough estimate from some limited studies that we have done is by shifting from one category of seismic design, say low to medium, we might be reducing the impact by 30%. So this is really worth doing.
Mm. And when people now are building new structures, so we have one set of issues with existing structures, but you would think that if you're going to start now, today, that you could then incorporate greater robustness in your structure when it comes to earthquake tolerance. It's easier to do that at the beginning than it perhaps to come back and do it later. So if you take a look at what people are doing with buildings now or what building codes are requiring, is it any better in terms of earthquake resistance than it was 50 years ago?
Unfortunately, the answer is not straightforward because there are two aspects. Seismic design or earthquake design is advantageous, but also normal design or design to normal loads could include some features that would automatically, without even the designer or the owner noticing, would improve the seismic resistance. Mm-hmm. So my answer is twofold. Seismic design is still not mandatory, but the quality of the design rules that we have now are much, much better than before in terms of general tying of everything to everything else. When we tie members together, beams to columns, roof to members, everything is tied together, we get an unintentional level of earthquake resistance. So on this, on the one hand, this has improved quite a bit. On the other hand, seismic design is not mandatory.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Amer Al-Nashai. He is head of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about what would be the potential effect of a serious earthquake, a major earthquake on the New Madrid Fault. This is something that we have certainly heard about on and off over the last few years. There have been small quakes, but we do know that in the past there have been big ones. And the question that Professor Al-Nashai and some of his colleagues here at the Mid-America Earthquake Center undertook at the request of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, was, well, what exactly would be the effect? And they have produced a very detailed report, came out about a year ago. If you'd like to look at it, you go to the website of the Mid-America Earthquake Center, and they certainly project that There would be very serious damage if such a quake would occur. The worst impacted, the most severely impacted states would be Tennessee, Arkansas, and Missouri. But Illinois and Kentucky would also be impacted. And we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in damage, a lot of people needing medical attention, needing shelter, people without power, a lot of buildings destroyed, and things like pipelines and bridges, and effects on schools and hospitals. Really quite serious. So you can take a look at that, and questions on the program are welcome, too. We have several people. In fact, the lines are full. We'll get right back to it. And the next caller is in Arcola, line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I'm going to hang up and ask, get my answer off the phone, but I was wondering if we could get specific to Champaign County and talk about what kind of effects, maybe not very many, maybe I'm just being selfish to want to know about us, but tell us about what it would look like in Champaign-Urbana if the 7.7 earthquake hit. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the question.
Okay. Champaign-Urbana will be affected very little indeed in terms of intensity of shaking. That we will feel the 7.7, we will indeed. It will be of a much longer duration than what we felt a couple of years ago. There was an earthquake in April of maybe 2008, 2009. Mm. It was strongly felt. This was a very close hit. It was not on the New Madrid Fault. It was on the Wabash Valley mechanism. It was about 4.8, 4.9. So we will feel very sustained shaking, meaning that it will last for maybe a minute and a half or something, as opposed to the few seconds that that a local earthquake will be felt, but the shaking will not be violent. There will be minimum damage, nothing major at all. We will see that now that Champaign has high-rise buildings for the first time in history, the high-rise buildings will actually move quite a bit. The higher the building, the higher buildings respond to distant earthquakes, and the shorter buildings respond to local earthquakes. So we'll see these of high-rise buildings on Green Street possibly getting some damage in the glazing and glass falling off and so on. But the effects would be rather limited. What would affect us more is utility services will be disrupted in a major way because all our utility services are coming from somewhere else. Gas pipelines will be ruptured all over the New Madrid Fault, and we have done work for the two major fuel suppliers, if you like, and their pipelines would be hit quite badly. We will also possibly see major migration from the southern parts of the state northwards, as the damage will be quite extensive in the southern part and people will move elsewhere. If they move south, then they are moving into the hardest hit region, so they are likely to move north. So maybe our county will have to manage with accommodating large numbers of refugees, if you like, in the short and medium term. Mm.
And what would be the recovery period? Say we have people whose homes are destroyed. Maybe we have people that don't have power and who have to leave. No doubt we would be looking at a very serious rebuilding that would have to happen in certain stages. Obviously, we'd have serious needs for people's medical and housing needs right up front. And then over a period, as we've seen in New Orleans, over a period of time, you would have to deal with things, the most serious things first, and do triage like that. But how that kind of displacement that you're talking about, how long would you anticipate that would be in effect?
This is a tough question to answer, but we have looked at that. In the report, we estimate the situation after immediately after the earthquake, one day after the earthquake, 3 days and 1 week. The recovery models that exist are quite empirical, meaning that they are relatively inaccurate. Let me give you an example. For example, there are recovery models that are floating around in the world, and we implemented some of these in terms of, for instance, the utility networks. And they give number of repairs per day that are feasible, and hence you'd say after so many days the service would return to normal. Mm-hmm. And we threw in these numbers that came out of the models. And then during discussions with three pipeline operators. It turns out that these three pipeline operators are their plan is to actually contact subcontractors that will come in and repair the pipelines. They don't have personnel for repair. We checked on these subcontractors. They turned out to be the same. So the three major pipeline operators will
they
be calling.
They're all relying on the same guys to come and help
exactly.
them.
So that immediately invalidates the models that we are using that are not taking into account that it is the same group of people who will be called by three independent companies asking them to repair. So the recovery will be very, very painful, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And it is not easy. It's not possible really to estimate how long would it take. It depends very much on the interaction between engineering and social science, if you like, in the sense that some folks are self-reliant. You have extremes in the U.S. and in other countries in the world between those who will just travel to Europe and spend a couple of months touring until things get better, and those who are really stuck in the community and have nowhere to go and have no means to recover, and they would be reliant completely on local and state and federal support.
On to some other callers here. Champaign Urbana, this is line number three. Hello.
Hi. On Mount Rainier, there's at the top, there's seismic detectors, and in the town below, there's sirens, and they have a plan to get out of town. Now, is there an earthquake warning plan that would tell people to get out of their buildings, and what's the best thing to do if you're in a building during a quake? Okay.
So two questions. First, early warning. Is there technology? Yes. Is it used in the world? Yes. Is it used in our region? No. The technology is very well established. There are ways and means of giving perhaps maybe half a minute to a minute warning. Longer warnings are not possible unless you are talking about a tsunami or a seismic wave. Seismic wave depends on where it's happening, but you can have a warning of an hour and a half, depending on where it is. But in terms of the actual shaking from an earthquake, it is very, very difficult. The technology depends on having instruments quite deep in the ground that would be triggered and sending a signal that there is a stress wave coming. And then you have these few seconds, if you like, or half a minute of a warning for people to evacuate. I think, of course, this doesn't really work in this way, but it has its very, very important applications. For example, in Japan, they have a system for slowing the bullet train. As soon as the triggering mechanism works, the bullet train brakes automatically without even the driver interfering. And hence, this half a minute is critical because it's traveling at 270 miles per hour or something, and it slows very rapidly and hence avoids major damage. In our region, we don't even have such technology. So this is one question. I can't remember what was the second half.
If you were, say, you there was an earthquake and you were at home or, I suppose, in any building, well, what do you do?
There are sort of guidelines. If you have, for example, if you have a robust dining table, a very good location for the family is under the dining table. If you cannot get to a dining table, then stand in the arch of a door, for example, because the door has a frame, and this frame would protect from falling debris and maybe roof tiles coming down and so forth. Avoid switching on fires and lights and electricity supplies. Avoid going to the stairwell and staircase. Don't try to run down the stairs because stairs are vulnerable and you would be subjected to things that are falling from various levels in a structure. If you are close to the external door, if you like, then get out of the building and keep at a safe distance from the building.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We did have some other callers, and my apologies if I kept them waiting too long. Perhaps we answered their questions in the course of the conversation, but certainly you have a question, you're welcome to call. We're talking here about the potential impact of an earthquake in our part of the country. Our guest is Amir Al-Nashai. He is head of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And I also want to mention, too, that if you'd like to read this report that we've been talking about here on the potential impacts of earthquake in the New Madrid seismic zone, it was something that you can look at if you go to the website of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the University of Illinois. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to call in. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, there's one aspect of this report I think is particularly interesting. It seems to me that when we talk about something like this, there is, and appropriately so, a major focus on infrastructure. So we're talking about potential impact on, as we've said, in schools and hospitals and roads and bridges and pipelines and communication networks and so forth. And so we ask questions about their resiliency. You also have a major section in the report here that is, and I guess I would use the same term, it looks at the resiliency of the population in the sense that you're asking this question, well, what sort of resources do they have that can help them cope with the effects? You know, and as you said, I mean, there are some people, I suppose, if they were affluent enough, could just leave, go someplace else. But certainly not everybody can do that. And in fact, within this area that we're talking about, this part of the Midwest, there are very high levels of people who don't have those kinds of resources and for whom it would be very, you know, the business of recovery, the process of recovery would be very difficult.
Yes, we do take that into account in the models, and the numbers that you see of displaced people are affected in this way. There is a significant body of work by quite a notable social scientist, Susan Cutter from University of South Carolina, and she is a colleague and a friend. And Susan developed something referred to as the Social Vulnerability Index. The Social Vulnerability Index is an sort of a compendium of factors in terms of income, age, health condition, education, and a few others, as also ethnicity and so on. Mm. The social vulnerability index we overlay it, if you like. Then we have a social vulnerability index distribution for the population, and we overlay it on top of the physical damage, and that gives us numbers as to who will need support and who can manage on their own to some extent. And these numbers that we are talking about are numbers that will need support. So that we take into account, and as we gather more information on the demographics, we improve our social vulnerability index distribution, and hence we get better estimates. But of course, the impact and recovery effort is really very heavily affected by the social structure.
Mm-hmm. And that means that there will be a large number of people that will be needing help, and no doubt they will be turning to government for that help, agencies like FEMA and others.
Indeed. And there are cases in the world where unexpected issues arise that nobody was able to model beforehand. If I give an example, in 2005, there was a major earthquake in Pakistan, the Kashmir earthquake, and the death toll was 80,000. Haiti is another example. But say if we stick with the Pakistan example, because of the time of occurrence of the earthquake, the number of children who were killed was much, much larger than anybody would have estimated, because it was during the daytime, schools were full, and schools are typically built by government agencies, and hence there is maybe higher uncertainty about their quality, whereas individuals look after their buildings, if you like, and keep an eye on contractors. Government is not so good at doing so, and hence you find that the number of families impacted by loss of children is just totally off the chart. And that then imposes immediately on the response effort that these have to be counseled, and there has to be rebuilding the social fabric, because these families are really totally demolished from from the psychological point of view.
Yeah. It's really striking how many variables, I'm sure, in doing this that you have to take into account. Just with the kind of example that you cited, I'm sure that if you're talking about the potential effects, that it might make a big difference whether we were talking about January or July, or whether we were talking about this happening on a Monday or Saturday, that the difference could be particularly, I'm sure, for major metropolitan areas, but I suppose for anywhere. The time of the year, the day of the week, the time of the day could make a big difference.
Yes, we do run we ran scenarios for time of the day, because that would make a huge difference in terms of estimating. Say, the infrastructure damage would be the same, but its impact on people's lives would be very different. Mm-hmm. You know, high-rise buildings are usually in downtown areas, they are not residential, and or rarely they are they residential, and hence they will be damaged, so they might affect business if it's during the day, and they will not affect many people if it's at night, and vice versa. We are not at a stage where we are able to do summer and winter scenarios. So what we do is that we estimate the impact, and then we say if it was summer, then there will be need for ice and water and so on. If it was winter, then there will be emergency heat provided and the like. But as you said, the parameters are too complex.
Yeah. And when we're talking about the potential impact on infrastructure, I suppose it also and how you who's responsible for trying to do some preparation. We're also, I suppose, complicated here that some of the things that we're talking about are in public hands, and some of the things are private. So then you have to put those things that are privately owned, like, say, a gas pipeline, for example, where you've got to rely on the company to decide that it's important and to pay for it. And we're talking about something very different if we're talking about a road or a bridge.
Yes, indeed. And this public-private partnership is really necessary. From the state point of view, there is actually a county emergency manager at this mm-hmm. at the county level. And then there is in Illinois, there's the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. And they have an earthquake plan. They didn't used to have an earthquake plan before 9/11. And so the earthquake research community, we were thinking that after 9/11, all the funding will go towards terrorist attacks and so on, and we will be deprived of funding. Actually, it turned out to be not at all like that. Central government, federal government was wise enough to say that let us look at all aspects of what our society is being subjected to in terms of natural and man-made risks, if you like. And that ended up with each state now has to have an earthquake plan, and mm-hmm. Illinois has an earthquake plan. Implementing it is a different story. Having the plan is a very good step. But as you said, how would you impose on pipeline companies to spend millions of dollars to retrofit their network when they are private? You have no say on what they do and what not to do. So this requires legislation and the complication of running legislation through the various channels and so you know whoever will bring it up might not be elected again because he or she is demanding quite a premium from industry. Hmm.
We just want to tell people who are listening that maybe we have about 5 minutes here. If someone has a question, do get on the telephone, and we're trying to get you in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. A little earlier in the program, I asked about the level of interest in this report, and you did say that, in fact, many people have downloaded the report from your website, so people are looking at it. I guess one group in particular that I wonder about their level of interest is the insurance industry. How do people in that business think about this?
There is a very limited number of earthquake insurance policies in our region, so the interest is not sharp. Mm. And the policies are distributed in such a way that the insurance industry will not be hit hard. The insurance industry works on distributing the risk, if you like. And that is a challenge in the earthquake business in particular, because, if you like, when they insure against kitchen fires, for argument's sake, kitchen fires in various households within a region are not correlated. But when you look at earthquake impact, it is totally correlated. It's one event that affects everybody. They have a good system in terms of distributing the risk by distributing the policies. But actually, insurance is not a major issue in our region because it's not necessary.
Yeah. Well, that's and I suppose it's worth mentioning. I guess that your average homeowner's policy generally does not address natural disaster. So whatever it is you think that you might be exposed to, flood, tornado, earthquake, it is possible to insure against those things, but that's you have to make that arrangement and have that be part of your policy. And I suppose that, most people, unless maybe they live in a place where they're very sensitive to a particular kind of threat, are not going to think about that.
That's true. I mean, there are many, many more flood insurance policies, of course, in our region than earthquakes.
Mm-hmm. Then just that gets to another thing I guess we really haven't touched on. And I mentioned the fact that if you look at the maps, and there are a number of maps on that are part of this report so that you can see about the geographic area that we're talking about. We do have a major body of water here that runs through this area. That's the Mississippi River, and I suppose there are others. Would there be some sort of dramatic effect on the streams and rivers in this area?
We have not looked, and there are no models to predict whether there will be a repeat of what happened in 1811, 1812. There were reports that the stream of the Mississippi was reversed, and and there were major, so almost like mini waterfalls, if you like, because of differential movement and so on. But what this reminds me of is flooding because of damage to dams, and that we actually did. We did the modeling of what will happen to dams, and then we estimate the amount of water discharged when the dam fails. And then we flooded, if you like, areas using GIS tools. And then we count the inventory that would be underwater. And strangely, there is a fair amount of infrastructure that would be flooded because there is a large number of dams in our region.
Well, we're down here to the point where we have about a minute or so left. And I'm sure that depending upon who we're talking about, people are going to come at this and have different levels of interest, whether you're a citizen and a homeowner, or whether you're somebody who's in business or you're somebody who's in government. For your average citizen, what would you like them to take away from this?
Well, one thing that would be of great benefit to society is to press our representatives to look at the critical facilities. Issues of there are several million homes in the region. There are 43 million people living here. To retrofit individual houses is perhaps not the top priority. The top priority would be to retrofit the essential facilities, hospitals. Imagine, for instance, the prison population. If a prison is damaged to the extent that the prisoners escape, this happened in Peru 2 years ago. You have, 300, 400 felons in a small region and sort of rejoicing their release and going on the rampage. Mm-hmm. And to round them up took many, many months. There are many critical issues in our society that really needs look after. There are nuclear power plants in our region. There are chemical plants. There are sewage treatment plants. These are our top priorities, to both reduce our exposure to these high risks and also to make life sort of manageable for the population, even though they might have lost their home or the utility networks are not working well. At least there is a hospital to go to. There is a police station to control the situation. There are electricity power plants that are generating and so on.
There we'll have to leave it. Once again, let me just say that if you would like to read this report, and it is quite detailed, you can look in as much detail as you like, or you can just get the overview. This report on the impact of earthquakes on the New Madrid seismic zone, go to the website of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at University of Illinois, housed within the Department of Engineering, and you can download that report, and you can see in detail what is there. Our guest, Amir Al-Nashai, is head of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thank you very much for
talking. Thank you for having me.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, with four area locations, inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
We'll take a break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the midpoint on this Friday. Wheat showing modest strength in some contracts, although it's a little bit choppy. Corn, though, on the is also showing a little bit of choppiness with the nearby to the downside, but the deferred's a little bit stronger. And then the beans are down a few cents to as many as 7.5 cents at the moment. Let's look at particulars.